K. Jackson, Milwaukee's real news and great conversation. A Civic Media station.
CBS News Brief. New research from Stanford says the U.S. will hit millions of measles cases over the next 25 years if vaccine rates drop just 10%. CBS's Matt Piper.
At current state-level vaccination rates, their model predicts that measles could become entrenched, resulting in what the researchers say would be hundreds of thousands of cases where deaths are commonplace.
In Vatican City, more than 90,000 people have paid their respects to the late Pope Francis at St. Peter's Basilica, including the pontiff's relatives and this man.
He looked very tranquil and peaceful.
The funeral is scheduled for Saturday. President Trump blasts Russia for launching an attack on Kyiv, killing at least a dozen people.
A thing like last night, I wasn't happy with it, and we're in the midst of talking peace, and missiles were fired.
Trump says he believes Russia wants peace despite Moscow's continued assaults on Ukraine. CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
The NFL Draft is underway. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with Sports in Green Bay, where the draft is going on just outside Lambeau Field. 5 years ago, the Packers selected quarterback Jordan Love out of Utah State in the first round. What was it like getting the call from Green Bay?
You know, it was a total shock. I think going into that year, we had a pretty good feel of what teams were looking to draft quarterbacks. And, you know, once some of those guys with Joe Burrow and Tua and Justin Herbert were taken by some of those teams, it was kind of up in the air, like who might be taking a quarterback next. So, you know, I had to play the sit and wait game for a little bit, and we got down to 26. And I definitely had no idea about the Green Bay Packers. You know, I don't think anybody realized they're going to take a quarterback with having A-Rod still there. But so it was definitely a shock to me, but it was great news.
Baseball, the Brewers losing to the Giants 6-5. The road trip continues tomorrow night against the Cardinals in St. Louis. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
April is Global Volunteer Month. Wisconsin's volunteers are transforming our communities every day through their acts of service. Wondering how you can give back? Find the perfect volunteer opportunities at volunteerwisconsin.org or contact your local United Way or Volunteer Center. On VolunteerWisconsin.org, you can filter opportunities by location, organization, cause, accessibility, and more to find your best fit. VolunteerWisconsin.org is hosted by United Way of Wisconsin and Serve Wisconsin. Paid for by United Way of Wisconsin.
You're listening to 540 WAUK, Waukesha's home for mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Evidently, the economy tanking is no longer Joe Biden's fault. Jerome Powell's fault. The Federal Reserve chair, because Trump went after him, slammed Powell as, what do you call him, Mr. Too Late, called him a major loser, went on his social thing and just went all Trumpian, and blamed him for everything, blamed Powell for everything, not the tariffs, not the chaos, none of that. It's Powell's fault for not lowering interest rates. Where you've got Powell, who's concerned that the tariffs are going to cause inflation. He's kind of being a little hesitant, which, you know, given the chaotic nature of what Trump is doing, you kind of see it. Now, here's the weird thing. Wasn't Jerome Powell one of the very best people? Wasn't he Trump's choice back in 2018? Wasn't this the guy? Yeah, it was. And like I tell my Trump friends, eventually you get tossed under the bus. So be careful what positions you take. Could be very uncomfortable. And the weird thing is, and I say this to all my Trump supporter friends, because eventually it's going to be all of us who he goes after. But I'm surprised at how many of my red hats are still arguing that you know, Trump overturning and doing away with due process is a good thing. And the new one First it was, I don't care, we're getting rid of the illegals, we're getting rid of the others. Now the argument is kind of switches. Well, it's only due process is only for citizens. No, it's not. Stop it. Show you have at least half a brain. And maybe the other half is just muddled with who knows what it is that you're smoking. But the reason I bring this up is because I saw this story coming out of Lancaster, California. Their mayor, Republican, Rex Paris, evidently claims that he wants to purge his fair city of all the homeless. Going to get rid of all of them. In fact, said that he wanted to give them all the fentanyl that they would want. His quote was, they are responsible for most of our robberies, most of our rapes, and at least half of our murders. See, I thought that was all MS-13. I thought this was all illegals. Now it's the homeless. I says, there's nothing we can do for these people. And immediately my mind goes to the, again, we just came out of some holiday that the Christian Nation folks really get behind. There was a guy that, you know, came back that, you know, maybe they might want to read some of his teachings. I don't know. You know, the homeless, the hungry, you know, the sick. Because understand, and this is the point, you know, they're going after the immigrants. Now we're going after the homeless. They've been going after the gays. You know, the poor. Come on. I mean, they've created most of them. When do they come for you? When does this trickle down? When does it get far enough down to get each and every one of us? I know. And I can already see the emails coming. Well, you know, we got to do something. What do you do for those people who won't help themselves? And, you know, we used to understand how to do things. We used to do things a little bit better. We used to, I don't know, be a little more helpful. Now you go, but Rick, you know, the homeless, we usually scoop them up and put them into insane asylums. And that's true. You know, we do need to figure out how to deal with the homeless situation in a better way than that. But I'm sorry, rounding them up and sending them somewhere else, I don't know, maybe to an El Salvadorian prison, I don't think is the right way to deal with it. Because you know what? And this is the hard part to swallow for a lot of people. Every one of those folks, every one of those homeless, every one of those hungry, every one of those who are living in poverty, those are someone's children. Those are someone's parents. Those are someone's brothers and sisters. Those are someone. And in a country that speaks of, in its constitutional documents, of all being equal and all having rights and life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness and all of these things, you would think that maybe not targeting them in a way that what this guy is saying, he wants to kill them all. He wants to give them enough fentanyl that they go away. And that's not a nice term. He's not doing that in the softest of ways. He's saying he wants to murder these people. And the weird thing is, I know I'm going to get emails from people going, well, that's probably best. I can see it coming. And this is why I've gone back and, you know, I've been saying this for a while now. You'd have told me 15 years ago that we'd be a country that would be okay with watching someone die on the street. I'd have said, no, that's not us. We're better than that. I got to ask the question, especially in a place like Lancaster, California. Are we better than that? Are we still better than that? Or were we ever? Maybe it's just the way I saw the world. That, you know, neighbors tried to help, especially in poor neighborhoods and poor communities. I want to hear your thoughts. Are we there? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Got to hear this one. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, will the Roberts Court help us or are we screwed? Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I gotta tell you, you know, first Christy Noem loses her purse. You know, what she's doing walking around with $3,000 in her purse, I don't know. But loses her purse, good thing it wasn't a nuclear football. And now you got Pam Bondi. Remember, very best people. Or no, that was the last administration. Never mind. But, you know, Pam Bondi was on Fox News, and I think she nailed the quote that will be her legacy. If you remember the woman who said alternative facts, you're always going to remember that. But Pam Bondi, in the most weird way, and I got this Nixonian vibe. You remember Nixon, you know, the I'm not a crook, and if I do it, it's not illegal. Well, he didn't have a Pam Bondi because Pam Bondi said on Fox, it's probably a crime to accuse the president of committing a crime after he breaks the law. See, Nixon just didn't lay the groundwork. Didn't have a Bondi as attorney general. Didn't have the Roberts Court. Yeah, it's going to be interesting. And the weird thing is this is Trump laying the groundwork. As you may remember back in September of 23, he talked about going after the media, saying that they should be investigated for country-threatening treason, and that those media people, enemy of the people. So are we seeing that play out? Yeah, a little bit. And here to share some thoughts on where we are and, well, how ineffective will the Roberts Court be in holding Trump accountable for what he is breaking the law of, since Bondi thinks it's going to be a crime just to accuse him of it? I've asked Megan Hatcher-Mays to come share some thoughts with us. She's a senior advisor over at United for Democracy. You can check out their website, unitedfordemocracy.us. Megan, thanks for taking time for us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
So what do you make of this? You got the attorney general saying, well, if you accuse the president of breaking the law after he breaks the law, well, we're coming after you. What kind of weird upside down Orwellian utopia are we in?
Yeah, it's not a very good, I don't like it. I don't want to be in it anymore. It is interesting because she sort of implies that he has, in fact, committed a crime in that statement.
Right.
You know? So it's very interesting. But I think what they're banking on, just like you said, is they're just banking on the Roberts Court to do absolutely nothing about it. You know, I think, I know a year ago, the Roberts Court, in this majority opinion written by John Roberts and joined by the MAGA justices, it's a case, I think, kind of fittingly called Trump versus the United States. In that case, the court said the president has broad immunity from criminal prosecution for breaking the law while president, as long as it's a part of his official duties. They basically gave Trump this gold-plated get out of jail free card. And I think when you hear Pam Bondi and other people in Trump's administration make statements like that, it's a dare. You know, they're basically saying, who's going to check us? Who's going to stop us? Because John Roberts said that this was cool. The only person who can rein us in is John Roberts. And we're daring him to do it. We're daring him to try. And right now, John Roberts isn't showing much fight. I don't even think he is attempting to rein them in, really. I mean, there were some signs of life over the weekend. You know, the Supreme Court kind of was like, wait a minute, you can't just cut the courts out of these deportation proceedings entirely. And so they did start to show some concern very late at night on a Saturday, of course, when everyone was sleeping. So that's when John Roberts will stand up for democracy, when no one's paying attention.
But otherwise, moments he woke up and go, oh, that was just indigestion.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So, you know, otherwise it's like, is he going to do anything about this? I mean, you have Trump out here defying court orders, both lower court orders and Supreme Court orders, just kind of ignoring them and doing whatever he wants. I think he thinks he has permission to do it. And John Roberts is not making him think twice about that belief.
And that's the weird thing for me, Megan, because, you know, I thought Roberts would, you know, I don't know, think about his legacy. I mean, he's still a youngish guy, but, you know, he's been on the court a while. He's shaped decisions. And look, you know, I remember Mr. Balls and Strikes. You know, at least that's what he claimed. I don't know what game he was playing, because we've overturned a lot of precedents, even though he said he believed in that decided law thing. But his, you know, his legacy is on the line here. And do you really want to be the guy that goes, yeah, I'm okay with a dictator. Fascism's cool.
He's certainly getting us pretty close. I think right now, I think he feels like, look, I've written rulings that are vague enough, that have big enough loopholes, that I can still claim that Donald Trump is in compliance with what I have said to do. So in the Abrego Garcia ruling, Roberts writes, the Trump administration should do what they can to let the courts know how they're going to bring about the return of Abrego Garcia from El Salvador. And the Department of Justice has said, well, there's nothing we can share about how we're going to do that. So if I'm John Roberts, I'm thinking, well, that counts. Now I don't have to make that final ruling. That he, I think right now he's in a place where he is doing his level best to avoid having to answer that final question, which I think what am I going to do about this constitutional crisis that we're in?
Right.
And that's what he's trying to avoid. And so what we're seeing is a lot of very mealy-mouthed and very vague rulings from his court, for the most part, that still give Trump quite a bit of leeway to comply, even though Abrego Garcia is still in El Salvador. I would argue that these court orders are being defied and ignored. I think that that's what puts us in this crisis.
Right.
John Roberts just doesn't want to have to answer that final question. I think he's going to go down in history as a massive, massive coward, because we are in the crisis. Somebody needs to do something about it. The court can, in fact, hold Trump and his administration officials in contempt. Lower court judges have already said that they think that there is probable cause to hold some of them in contempt for the way that they've behaved. And John Roberts needs to put up or shut up. And right now he's shutting up.
So let's walk through this, because, you know, the question that popped into my head is, okay, let's say he woke up in the middle of the night and it wasn't just indigestion. He actually found a spine and he wanted to, you know, he said, you know, this is too far. What power do they have if he makes a ruling and they ignore it? What power do they have to enforce it?
I think that's the question, right? I mean, we've never been in this situation before. I'm not a historian, so if there are historians listening or watching, please feel free to email me.
Educate us.
Yeah, please let us know. But that's the scary thing. Nobody really knows what happens next, because we've never been this close to the brink before. Like, yeah, we got pretty close with Richard Nixon, but we also had a Congress who was willing to hold Nixon accountable, and we don't have that now.
How do you take out the commander in chief?
Exactly.
That's
the question. It's like, it's impeachment, and nobody in Congress, or at least 2/3 of Congress, don't want to be responsible for that, at least not yet. I think that could change, actually, depending on how mad people get.
But not in a Republican House. That's never going to happen. So all of my people are saying, we got to impeach him. Oh, shut up. Sit down. Let's get through today. In 2 years, if you get a Democratic House that is going to do something, you get a Democratic Senate. Yeah, okay, we can begin the conversation, but still, no profiles in courage in Congress right now.
No, not right now. And so I can't totally answer your question. That's the scary moment that we find ourselves in, is that we don't totally know. Yes, officials can be held in contempt. That could mean fines. That could mean prison time. But no judge wants to hold the president of the United States in contempt. Nobody wants to, because it's scary, you know. Judges,
especially if you're going to be ignored. Kind of
they're going to be ignored, but also, like, who is going to arrest him? The FBI? Like, it's all these things that have never come up in American history before. And also, a lot of judges have reported being fearful of their safety for ruling against Donald Trump. Even in, like, smaller potatoes cases, they have, a lot of judges are reporting getting death threats and things like that. So
I've gotten some of those emails from the red hats.
Yes.
And you know, you write most of it off as just a bunch of keyboard warriors who couldn't get out of their own way. But you never know. There might be that one that, you know, he's sitting in his bunker somewhere surrounded by his arsenal. You never
yeah,
know.
You don't. Yeah, you don't know. And especially with this president, who we know has an affinity for encouraging insurrections, like, I think it's a totally reasonable fear. I think what we've discovered just throughout Trump's first term and throughout the first 100 days of this one is that our democracy is very tenuous. It's really just agreements on paper. And the reason that it's worked up to this point is because we all agreed to follow the rules for the most part. Most of us did. And this guy just doesn't do that. And I think it's really caused us to confront what mechanisms we do have to hold people accountable, especially when you have a legislative branch who's disinterested in real accountability or oversight over a president who's clearly completely out of control. Like, actually, Congress should be more mad. I mean, you have Donald Trump, who's basically eliminating their authority by fiat. Like, Congress doesn't do anything because the president is doing everything through executive order or just by sheer force of will. If I were a member of Congress, I'd be like, hey, that's my job. Yeah. He's coming for my job. I'd be pissed. But they're just kind of like, no, we love it.
Do you remember when
keep going?
Do you remember when Republicans were against executive orders? Do you remember
that? Yeah. Every 4 years when there's a Democratic, or 8 years when there's a Democratic president, oh, they hate executive orders.
Remember how cute that was? Remember how they were fiscally responsible and they believed in the rule of law?
Yes.
Remember how they can you go back that far and remember? Because wow.
All the way back to 2024.
Yeah,
when they hated executive orders.
And do you remember when we used to believe in that cute little thing? Because I went to the George W. Bush Presidential Library right when it opened up, and they got this cute little toy in there. It's a little triangle on a ball, and you're trying to figure out how to balance the powers of this triangle.
Mm.
It was one of the most high tech things I've seen in a presidential library. It was just a piece of wood on a ball, and you were trying to. This hard task of balancing these three branches or these three corners of the triangle, which were branches of government. Now we've just kind of smashed that.
Yes, absolutely. I think to the extent that the Supreme Court cares about this, it's because they don't want to lose power for themselves. I think that they have grabbed a lot of power for themselves over the last 5-10 years of sort of John Roberts's reign as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Like, they ruled a couple years ago in a ruling called Relentless that they can kind of overrule any federal regulation that they want. That means, so if like the Department of Labor comes up with a rule or regulation about overtime or workplace safety, if the Supreme Court's like, well, we don't really like that, they just gave themselves the power to get rid of it. And they have invented these doctrines called the major questions doctrine, which just lets them weigh in on legislation that they may or may not like. They don't really have to have a reason. Usually if you go to court, there has to be some reason. And the court probably shouldn't be weighing in on legislation that's been passed democratically enacted through both chambers of Congress. But if they don't like it, they said, oh, we can weigh in and get rid of it if we want. That's a lot of power for the Supreme Court to take for themselves. And so to the extent that Donald Trump is kind of threatening this little fiefdom that they've carved out for themselves, they don't like that. They're not so fussed about how any of this affects real people, working people, women, immigrants, marginalized communities. They don't really care about that. But if it affects their fiefdom, their little pile of power, they are mad about that. And so I think we saw a little bit of that over the weekend in some of the, and this pushback over some of the immigration activities that the Trump administration has been engaging in. But otherwise, this court has been perfectly happy to let Trump be Trump.
Well, look, he put three of them there. I mean, you know, they're this is why this court was built the way it was built. You know, Leonard Leo didn't spend all that money and all that time and energy with the Federalist Society building an entire echo chamber of judges who think the same way and know how to vote without being lobbied. So all this talk of, you know, that they bought and bribed Clarence Thomas. No, he was bought and paid for long before he got on the court. as with the rest of them, because they were put into this machine and spit out like bad sausage. And here we are. We're the ones who are going to have to eat this garbage and suffer because of it. So the question that I have, because I think we both agree. There's no real hope, I believe, in the Roberts Court. I think Trump is waiting for that opportunity to just consolidate power as much as is possible. The fortunate thing, he's not going to live forever, and I don't see anyone, you know, coming up behind him. What does that mean for the rest of us? What does that mean for, you know, for working people who are afraid that this court's going to overturn parts of the NLRA, that we're going to go back to the days of Lochner and end up, you know, in a desperate, you know, exploitable condition again? You know, what does that mean for us?
I mean, that's something people should be very, very genuinely afraid of. That's something that keeps me up at night. It's like this idea that Congress can't regulate workplace safety at all, can't regulate minimum wage. I think that is very likely to make a comeback with
very
this
Lochner-esque.
They're dragging us back to the 19th, 20th century or early 20th century.
Well, I say all the time they want to repeal the 20th century, and they're doing a pretty damn good job of it.
Yeah, no kidding. So I think that, like, honestly, where this lies is it's very hard to protest against the Supreme Court in the same way you can protest or advocate for your issues with your members of Congress. So I think that is really the key. I think a lot of times the courts are sort of ignored by some of our elected officials because they think people care more about the economy. The reality is everything that you care about, pick an issue, is at risk in front of this Supreme Court. Economy, reproductive rights, whatever, workplace safety, labor protections, all of that stuff is under threat. And in fact, a lot of it has already been gutted by this court already.
Because here's where my position has been. And I said this on basically on election day forward, that bad things are going to happen. Lots of bad things are going to happen. The horrible is going to happen. And the line I've been using is the solutions for our future are going to come from the suffering due to their savagery. So all of the horrible stuff that they're going to do, and they're going to do it, and the court's going to bless a lot of it. We're going to have to come to solutions as we go through this. And one of those solutions that I think has to be brought up is how we deal with our Supreme Court. This idea that they're there for life, and we have this crazy majority that is now
exactly
kind of off the deep end, is one of the solutions. You know, I've heard, you know, some want to pack the court, some want term limits, some want, you know, to be able to, you know, to replace people at certain intervals. Is there a solution here that you see, or do we not know that yet?
There is absolutely a solution. And I think that is where all of our energy should lie. It's like, those are the sorts of questions we should be demanding of our elected officials. Like when they have town halls, like, or if there's a primary in your district or whatever, those are the questions we should be asking candidates too. Like, what is your plan to deal with the Supreme Court? Cause we can pass legislation all day. We can expand the NLRA all day. We can increase the minimum wage all day. But if this court is still in the form that it is in now, we don't stand a chance of keeping any of that progress that we might make, even in a democratically in a Democrat majority House and Senate or in presidency. Like if the Democrats get a trifecta again, we could pass stuff all day. If John Roberts and Brett Kavanaugh and Clarence Thomas and Alito and Amy Coney Barrett are still in the majority, we're not going to be able to keep much of any of that stuff. So there needs to be a plan. To your point about specifics, yes, like one option would be adding seats from 9 to 13. The Supreme Court has been expanded and shrunk many times over its history. It's perfectly constitutional for Congress to pass that. You don't need a constitutional amendment. You could just pass a law that expands the number of seats. Term limits is another really good option. There's a term limits bill already pending in Congress that has a lot of Democratic support, introduced by Hank Johnson from Georgia on the House side and by Sheldon Whitehouse from Rhode Island on the Senate side. Ethics reform is obviously a big one. You know, the Supreme Court justices don't have to follow the same ethics code as every other federal judge, which is kind of crazy since they get a lot of perks for public officials.
Yeah, but here's I'm one of the few people who's going to say, I don't believe that they were bribed. You know, just because Alito goes on the trip doesn't mean he's going to necessarily, you know, go with or for. I think he's already been trained that they don't need to give him any sweeteners to do what they know he's going to do.
I don't think it's a bribe to get them to do what they want. I think it's a reward for doing what they like. Either way, not good. Really not a good state of affairs.
And I'll tell you, you know, because of Alito, I am now reevaluating my friend group. because none of them have taken me on, you know, $100,000 vacations or any of that.
I was like, how is it I don't have any friends with the private jet? That's outrageous. That's outrageous. So those are some of the options. I mean, and whatever it is, whatever this is, it has to be, it can't just be one thing. There's no one reform that's going to solve this problem. It has to be a big package of stuff. For your viewers, listeners who know about the For the People Act, it was this big package of democracy reforms that included voting rights, you know, election security. It included a ton of stuff all in one, all aimed at, you know, giving our democracy a little bit more fortitude. Yeah. Too bad that didn't pass. Thanks for nothing, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. But whatever we do about the courts has to be that same sort of thing. It has to be a bunch of things all together that really go towards immediately fixing our problem with the Supreme Court to long-term fixing some of the issues that where partisan interference plays a larger role in the selection of justices and the confirmation of justices. So whatever that is, it has to be a big package. But yeah, to your question about what we can do, that is it. That's like it. We really need to be pressing our elected officials about what they're going to do about the court, because the court is tangled up in everything you care about.
No, and look, we need politicians, especially Democrats, to find a spine. I say all the time, you know, in a street fight, a Democrat will offer to hold your coat. I want somebody who's going to do a little more. But Megan, I appreciate your thoughts, the work you do. You guys do great stuff. Hope folks will check out the website, unitedfordemocracy.us. We'll get links out. Megan Hatcher-Mays, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks.
Want to hear your thoughts. Is she right? Is the court the target? I want to hear it. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. And then what do you think we should be doing about it? I'm generally not a term limit guy, but I kind of see it. Right back after this.
A voice for real news and great conversation in Milwaukee. 540 WAUK.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Turning mostly cloudy tonight, some showers around late and lows in the low 40s. And more areas of rain for tomorrow, cooler day, highs in the mid-50s and cloudy. Sunshine's back as we look into Saturday, but a wind off the lake will keep the high at 50, mid-50s Sunday. Right now it's 53.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
The advantage of being a high school dropout is what you don't have. Like, you don't get it. That is below the dignity of your station, man.
Derek Van Orden wants you to know, as a kid, he was on food stamps. He was raised by a single mom. Me too. Attacking and belittling a witness, using your personal story to somehow justify it, it doesn't make you right. You know what's below the dignity of your station? Being a jerk while someone is raising valid concerns about the jerk move that you're about to make.
Catch Mornings with Pat Kreitlow at its new time, weekdays 6 to 9 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So some good news for right-wing radio hucksters. Gold. Gold is up. If you're selling gold coins, gold is up. On Monday, broke $3,400, and that's one of these things that's directly attributed to Donald Trump. They're saying this is because of Trump's threats to the Federal Reserve, and also, you know, the insanity of his tariffs. People are running for gold. Evidently, gold has jumped about 29% since the start of the year, 8% since the April 2nd. Unfurling of the tariff. And oh, by the way, my friends in the Lehigh Valley in Pennsylvania, Mack Truck is going to be laying off somewhere between 250 and 350 employees over the next couple of months. And what are they citing? The craziness of these tariffs that don't seem to have any strategic value at this point. Just chaos. And here to share some thoughts on what this all means, I've asked Ryan Mulholland to come talk with us. Ryan's a senior fellow for international economic policy. I can't even say it. I'm here to talk about a new paper that they've just put out. Ryan, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, Rick, great to be back. Good to talk to you again.
So you got Mack Truck saying, hey, we're laying people off because of the tariffs. Gold's happy. Thoughts?
Well, you mentioned it. I mean, a lot of this is just chaos, right? It is a reaction to not knowing what tomorrow brings. Are we going to have tariffs or are we not going to have tariffs? What level are they going to be at? Are we going to double them overnight? you know, people are fleeing U.S. markets and they're trying to find assets that are more stable in uncertain times.
Now, you got your guys' paper is looking at individual states, how things are going to play out if these tariffs go into place. And I look at the Lehigh Valley, you know, this Mack truck, is this the first? Is this the canary in the coal mine? Or, you know, let's take Pennsylvania. How bad could tariffs be in the way that Trump has laid them out for my state of Pennsylvania right now?
Yeah, I mean, you just look at there's sort of a couple things to think about, right? One is sort of the impact that tariffs have on companies that make stuff in the U.S. Or sell things in the U.S. And a lot of those companies, particularly small, medium-sized manufacturers, import products from China. Sometimes it's materials, sometimes it's component parts. And listen, if you're the maker of iPhones, you know, maybe you can call up the president and get a sweetheart deal or an exemption. But most companies can't, right? Most companies are small, they're medium-sized, they're run by everyday Americans. They don't have the ability to sort of, you know, get into the White House and get an exemption. And so they're just going to pay, in the case against China, 145% tariff on whatever product or material that they're importing. And we all know a lot of companies run on very tight margins, particularly small, medium-sized companies. They don't have the ability to absorb that, right? And so already you've seen bankruptcies increase. My guess is you'll see bankruptcies increase even more as the tariffs sort of, you know, get more into effect. And then in addition to that, one of the things that we looked at in this paper you're mentioning is sort of the effect of retaliatory tariffs. You know, what the president has done has been so sort of belligerent that other countries are putting tariffs on U.S. products entering their market. And if you're an exporter, not only are you going to be paying more to make the thing that you make to export, but you're going to also be facing tariffs in other markets around the world. And so you're even less competitive. And of course, the downside of that is bad for workers, bad for benefits as margins get even tighter, right? So this is a double, triple, quadruple whammy facing a lot of workers in a lot of places. Pennsylvania, you know, certainly among them, but not the only one.
Now, you had talked about in your piece that about China, because look, I think, and I've said this, you know, for 20 years now, that I think tariffs are part of a strategy to bring China into line. They've been cheating for far too long, currency manipulation, intellectual property theft. We can go down the list of all the ways that they have gamed this system to their advantage. And we have been, one, unwilling to take them on, or two, unable to. So I think at some point you have to do this. But in your piece, you point out that as a retaliatory measure, that they're withholding rare earth minerals that are used in the manufacturing process, things like semiconductors, our turbines, fighter jets. And for me, isn't this kind of the reason why you want to figure out how to not have such a dependence on China and maybe anyone else?
Yeah, no doubt. Listen, let's be really clear. China is not, above criticism. I mean, what they've done for years is cheat the system, right? And they've put a lot of American workers out of work because of their sort of non-market, often illegal practices, right? And absolutely, they need to be stood up to. We need to take sort of strong strategic action to fight back. I think the issue that a lot of folks have with how the Trump administration has gone about this is the way you would fight back is to invest in our people, to invest in our industries, right? To work with our partners around the world who, by the way, are facing the same challenges from China that we face. And instead, we think tariffs alone are going to do the trick. And we've given businesses like 3 days to respond to 145% tariffs on Chinese products. And so it's just a kind of a foolhardy way to go about doing this. But I don't want to in any way suggest that China, you know, shouldn't be stood up to. I think, you know, we need to stand up for our industries and our workers. This just isn't the way to do it.
Now, I've had some conversations with my Trump supporter friends. And as you know, Donald Trump plays 5D chess. So he's so far ahead of us that, you know, there's a plan. We just don't know what it is yet. And some of the gaming, the thought process is that they've gamed this out, that they're going to make these threats that, you know, evidently we're going to then pull them back. And what's going to unite all of us around the globe, around China. And that's how this is going to work out. Do you have any sense that is even remotely possible? Or is it or do you think like I do that this guy's brain doesn't work that way, and I'm the chaotic nature is what it is, just chaos for chaos sake.
Yeah, I mean, if there's anything that you can go back to in history of Trump, and remember, he's been a political actor, even if he hasn't been elected official for decades now. There's nothing to suggest that chaos is not just part of his DNA, right? He loves chaos. So that is always going to be a part of this. I think there's a couple other things, though, to point out over time. One is he has a track record of being a fairly bad negotiator. For whatever he says about being the world's greatest negotiator, the facts just don't bear that out, right? So the phase one trade deal that he did with China, for example, in his first term, China committed to buying some $200 billion more of U.S. exports. Eventually, they bought zero, not a single dime more exports. They simply gave Trump the headline that he wanted, knew they could win all the details, never deliver, and that Trump and sort of the news media broadly would kind of move on and forget about it. You know, we saw early in this administration, we saw, huge threat of tariffs on Canada and Mexico, our two closest trading partners, and then a walk back from those. What did he get from Canada? He got them to name a fentanyl czar, which, by the way, they were already planning to create. Mexico was going to move troops to the border. Oh, by the way, they were already planning to move those troops to the border. So we didn't get anything of consequence. And yet we still, on a lot of products, have 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico. And it's hard to figure out a way for us to address China effectively without Canada by our side, right? And so I think that's part of the challenge here is that we are fighting a unilateral trade war against literally everybody.
Yeah, no, and Mexico too. I mean, I think Mexico's a key part of this, but help me refresh my memory, if you will. Didn't someone renegotiate a deal with Canada and Mexico? Wasn't there some great deal that happened then?
It was the greatest trade deal ever negotiated, I thought.
Wasn't that it? Didn't we just do this? What do they call it? The USMCA? Wasn't that the Trump sweetheart deal?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And as we start to think about deals, quote unquote, that Trump might negotiate over the next couple months to potentially get rid of some of these tariffs, I think we should be mindful that the lesson that world leaders have learned is that Trump is an unreliable negotiating partner. Right. If they could do one deal, figure out whatever they're going to figure out and move on, I think there would be world leaders that would be interested in doing that. The problem is nobody believes that's true. As soon as they agree to one thing, Trump will come slam more tariffs on or threaten more tariffs for something else. And so there's very little incentive for world leaders, to actually do a deal with the Trump administration. I think what you've seen, too, by the way, is what Trump has done to the stock market, what he's done to the bond market, he's basically dug an enormous hole for the U.S. economy. He's jumped in with 2 feet, and now he's begging other countries to throw him a rope. And yet he's belittled and embarrassed those countries' leaders over the last several months. Who wants to throw him a rope? He's in a pretty tough negotiating position.
Yeah, but Ryan, come on. We both know the economy is slowing down and Wall Street tanking. We both know that was Jerome Powell's doing. Jerome Powell did that, and a bad president appointed him. Oh, wait a minute. No, I'm sorry. He was one of the very best people because Trump appointed Powell. But now he's a loser. So he's the guy, Mr. Too late, too slow, too something. Loser. Yeah. Am I getting this right?
Yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is Trump's MO, though, right? Find somebody to blame and go after them. Find a scapegoat. That's sort of the theory of his politics for decades now.
And the weird thing for me is, the economy that he inherited was, it wasn't great for everybody, but it was doing all right. We were moving in a good direction. I thought Biden was doing some really good things on helping us reshore manufacturing, using tariffs smartly and strategically. I thought we were turning the ship a little. We weren't trying to do a U-ey, but we were just trying to turn a little bit. And now that's all been undone because we're the most untrustworthy country in the world now.
Yeah, and a part of the problem, too, is it's hard to win back trust, as anybody knows, right? So some of the damage that Trump has done in his first 100 days in this term will take years, if not decades, to recover as other countries around the world no longer look to the U.S. as a reliable partner.
Right.
And your point about the Biden administration, I think, is really well taken. I think what what we saw successfully done in the Biden term is sort of pairing sort of targeted strategic tariffs with investment, with Buy America procurement provisions, with tax incentives that encourage domestic production. It was, you know, tariffs were not the solution to the problem on their own. They were part of a larger package.
Exactly.
Which could help rebuild our industrial base.
So let me ask you this, because one of the concerns that I have is, while much like during Trump's first term, on the international leadership front, Trump basically walked away from Africa and China went in and filled the void with their Belt and Road program. I fear right now what's happening in back rooms across the globe is corporations are going, hey, we can't trust them. Foreign governments are going, hey, they're untrustworthy. How do we make deals with China to then move away from the U.S.? Because they're too chaotic to deal with. We go in this direction, which would be much worse, not just for us, but for the entire globe. But I fear that's happening.
Yeah, this is not America first. This is America alone, right? Other countries are walking away from the U.S. because we are unreliable under the Trump administration. And you're right, they're signing deals with each other. You know, even we saw Korea and Japan, for example, announce that they're going to work on regional trade with China. I mean, two of our closest partners in Asia for decades saying we can't trust the U.S. is going to be here. We've got to go work with Beijing, right? And you know, you're seeing the EU start to talk about more collaboration with China. You're talking, you know, Canada trying to work, you know, more with the EU. You know, there's lots of examples of this, and it's because the rest of the world is figuring out a way to push back against Trump and his sort of blunt unilateralism, recognizing that today's global economy is highly integrated, right? And so, you know, unilateral nationalistic tariffs are a thing of the past, and yet they've been fully embraced by the Trump administration, and the rest of the world is ready to move on.
Now, here's what my problem is, and I've said this from the very beginning, and I've stuck with it. My fear is he boogers this up so badly, we never use that tool of tariffs ever again. And I think it's a valuable, vital tool that has to be in the box. It's not the only tool in the box, but it's one of them. And I fear he screws this up so bad, it's another 100 years before we start using them again.
I worry about that too.
So last line of questioning I've got for you, because we started off talking about how the states are going to be the ones who are going to suffer and how they respond, you know, politically, you know, because ultimately this is going to come down to, you know, election time in a year and a half. Which states are the ones who are going to be hit hardest? Are they red states? Are they blue states? Is there a way that those governors then say, hey, wait a second, this wasn't supposed to be us? Do you see an uprising of the governors' associations or the states trying to push back on this?
Yeah, I do. I think you've already seen some of this already. You know, Gavin Newsom in California has done some trade work already. Westmore in Maryland, I saw, was in Asia last week trying to do some more trade work. I think the reality, though, and let's just be really clear, that as much as these governors would like to take a leading role in trade, international trade is a national government priority, right? So you could see a governor do more trade missions. You could see a governor sort of, you know, try to work on more matchmaking, you know, between U.S. exporters and foreign buyers. But policy around trade is really a national level thing. I think the bigger question is, will Congress actually step up and play a role in trade policy going forward? Because, you know, the Constitution actually gives Congress the authority to do that, not the president.
Right.
Trump has claimed sort of, you know, emergency authority, never used this authority before for tariffs. I think it's a quite dubious legal authority in terms of tariffs, International Economic Emergency Power Act, or IEEPA. Will Congress step up? I doubt it, you know, we can hope.
Yeah, there's no spine there yet. And look, they've already given in on everything else. Why not this too? But from my point of view, is it's the as I understand it, and you can help me here because you're the guy who wrote the paper and you're the expert on this. The way I'm seeing it, a lot of the red states are going to be hit hardest by this stuff because it's where we're manufacturing a lot of things. And, you know, those red state governors, they don't want to hear their constituents yelling and screaming. So I do see that there would potentially be some pressure, or do you not see it that way?
No, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. There will be pressure. I think the point in our paper was to simply make the case that retaliatory actions from other governments are going to impact every state. you know, obviously some more than others, clearly, but every state has major exporters to Canada, to the EU, and to China. Those are the countries that have retaliated so far. Now, after this 90 days, if countries don't have deals, it's likely that you'll see more retaliatory action, right? And that will have a real impact on, like I said, every state, every community, every industry. And the impact when you add it up overall, we're talking about millions of American jobs at risk because of not just Trump's tariffs, but because of how belligerently he's done this, the retaliation that's coming. And oh, by the way, that's not, we were looking simply at tariffs, but there's a lot of foreign consumers that are acting on their own, that are just not buying American-made stuff, right? Stores taking American products off their shelves, right? It's the government not telling them to do that. They're taking that action on their own. And the implication is it's harder to make stuff here, harder to be identified as a U.S. company. And ultimately, when it's bad for our exporters, it's bad for workers.
Yeah, it's hard for me to go from the bridge in Trenton, New Jersey that says Trenton makes the world takes to nobody wants our stuff because of just how bad the leadership of our country is. It's really disheartening. But Ryan, I appreciate you sharing some thoughts. Keep up the great work.
Thanks, Rick. Appreciate it. Take care.
Ryan Mulholland, Senior Fellow of International and Economic Policy there at the Center for American Progress. You want to check out their piece, AmericanProgress.org is where you will find it. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1970. That was the first observation of Earth Day. Across the United States, millions of people took to the streets and parks to demonstrate for clean air, water, and a reduction in pollution and care for nature and the environment. The idea for Earth Day began with Democratic Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson. He was inspired to action when he witnessed the devastation caused by an oil spill in Santa Barbara, California. Senator Nelson knew for the day to be a success, he needed to reach across the aisle. He found an ally in Republican Congressman Pete McCloskey. He also found support from organized labor. The national coordinator for Earth Day was Dennis Hayes. Hayes explained, quote, "Without the UAW, the first Earth Day would have likely flopped. The UAW was by far the largest contributor to the first Earth Day, and its support went beyond the merely financial. It printed and mailed all of our material at its expense, even those critical of pollution-belching cars." 20 years later, Earth Day truly went global. In 1990, it was estimated that 200 million people from 141 countries participated in Earth Day action. President Bill Clinton awarded Senator Nelson the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest honor granted to a U.S. civilian for his role in Earth Day. The role of the United Auto Workers in the first Earth Day demonstrates the importance that labor can play in the environmental movement.
All things and what they used to be not, oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you got Pete Hegseth at the Pentagon. You've got RFK Jr. at HHS. You got Dr. Quack over at, what is it, Medicare and Medicaid there. And Christy Noem at Homeland Security. Evidently, Christy couldn't even keep track of her own handbag. Evidently, the thief got away with her driver's license, some drugs, her medication, her apartment keys, a passport, her DHS access badge, a makeup bag, blank checks, and about $3,000 in cash. And as I asked earlier, you know, what is she doing walking around with $3,000 in cash? Don't even want to know. But here's the thing. The tariffs, as I've said, I'm in favor of using them strategically. This is not great. And look, I know some people at the Lehigh Valley Mack truck plant that are probably going to lose their job because of the erratic way that these are being laid out. Now, also understand, there's going to be some of the, well, you know, in defense of the market kind of stuff. And this is them planning because they don't know. So are they expecting soft demand because of the tariffs? Yeah. What was that going to happen regardless? We don't know, but I doubt it. So this is what we're going to have to pay attention to a lot over the next couple of weeks, because corporate America, they don't ever want to lose. You consumers, you're going to lose. You're going to pay higher prices just because, hey, in defense of the market, we got to raise prices. Also, you're going to hear a lot of, well, we got to go, can't give raises. Don't want to hear about any of that stuff. Now, the weird thing is these are the people who are tearing the system down, destroying things with the idea that, you know, we got to tear it down. We got to kill it to save it. That's always their mantra. We got to tear it down and out of the ashes. Yeah, the Phoenix thing. And, you know, I came across an interesting story, one that made me go, yeah, this is what the deregulation Wild Wild West is going to look like. Evidently, Tesla is being sued because I'm not sure how they're speeding up their odometers, but they're being sued in a class action lawsuit because it's being alleged that the odometers are being sped up so that they fall out of warranty faster. Now, the plaintiff, who alleged that his Tesla readings reflect energy consumption, how I guess it goes is it's energy consumption, it's driver behavior, and it's something they're calling a predictive algorithm, as opposed to actual wheels turning around and going faster and going more miles. So it's this predictive algorithm, driver behavior, and consumption of energy, which is weird. Now, the guy who's suing them says, you know, his odometer in 2020, the Model Y he bought in 2022 had 36,000 miles on it. And he's claiming that the clock is going at least 15% faster. Said that according to his driving history, for a while, it said he drove 72 miles a day, when at most he claims he drove 20 miles a day. And that, understand, you've got a basic warranty of 50,000 miles. If you're burning through those miles fast enough, the warranty goes away. And then when you need a rear end, when you need a suspension job, that's going to cost 10 grand. Well, sorry, you're out of warranty. And because again, this is all fiddling with, I guess, definitions. And if there's no one there to oversee what they're doing or how they're doing, kind of makes you wonder, what about everything else? Now, you've got Musk, who's got his fingers in all of our government and has a say in a lot of things that get done. Is this part of it? Now, this is a small thing, I believe, on the grand scheme of things. But it's another thing. It's another one of those things that, again, consumers are going to get the short end of the stick on. And I keep coming back to this idea that, you know, maybe we wake up. Maybe we stop drinking the Kool-Aid, so to speak. Because my entire lifetime, and, you know, this is one of those things that's remarkable to me. Because, you know, I made a comment in the last segment about, you know, the bridge in Trenton, New Jersey, that says Trenton makes the world takes. In my lifetime, we've gone from the world's producer to the world's consumer. We exported a lot of things. And during the 90s, we exported our manufacturing jobs. Because we were told we didn't need dirty manufacturing anymore. We didn't need those jobs anymore. And the reality is we do. We need jobs for every skill level, for every person's intellect, for every person's interest. And on a political economy level, if you're not able to make that kind of of economic opportunity for people, regardless of where they are, you're going to end up having a lot of problems with, you know, the others. And then you end up with homeless people where you've got mayors saying, hey, maybe we just give them a bunch of fentanyl. Yeah, maybe we send them somewhere else. We're in very troubling times. But I want to hear your thoughts. If you've got a Tesla and you're experiencing this, I'd love to hear more about it. But if you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcasts, you will find ours, freespeech.org. On Monday, we will be moving to a new time for our free speech audience, 3 p.m. For everybody else, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is 540 WAUK Jackson, Milwaukee's real news and great conversation. A Civic Media station.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. The Vatican says more than 90,000 people have paid their respects to Pope Francis as he lay in state inside St. Peter's Basilica.
To see the Pope in his simple coffin, it takes your breath away.
As the public mourning period continues, cardinals gathered again Thursday, part of a series of meetings before the conclave to elect the next pope. Before the conclave can begin, Saturday's funeral and burial, when Pope Francis will be laid to rest.
CBS News New York's Tony Aiello. President Trump blasts Russia on social media over the attack in Kyiv, Ukraine, that has killed at least 12 people, just as the U.S. works on a peace deal. In an exclusive CBS News interview, Margaret Brennan speaks with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov.
The statement by the president mentions a deal, and we are ready to reach a deal, but there are still some specific points.